This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Hey, it's Mark Arla Page, and I want to personally invite you to the Entree Architect Meetup at the AIA National Conference in Boston this June. This special event hosted by Entree Architect and Gable Media is open to all small firm architects, whether you're attending the conference or not. You don't need to be going to the conference. You can just come and hang out with us. Last year, over 100 architects joined us, and we're doing it again. Same energy, same amazing community. Grab your ticket and get all the details at entrearchitect.com/AIA25. AIA25, entrearchitect.com/AIA25. I'd love to see you there. My name is Mark Arla Page, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today I'm joined with Amos Peleg, co-founder of Peleg Kleinhaus Architects. Amos's journey into architecture wasn't straightforward. He originally resisted the profession, despite being a son of an architect. But after working with the tech mogul during the dot-com boom and helping sell a startup for over $500 million, he realized that business and entrepreneurship was his true path. Returning to Israel to care for his father, Amos revived his family firm alongside his partner, Tomer, and together, they've built one of the country's leading architecture practices. Amos Peleg, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. You have such an interesting story. I can't wait to dive into it and learn more about it. Trained as an architect, go off and get into the tech world, realize that business is your thing, and come back and go all in on architecture and build a thriving architecture business, which is near and dear to my heart. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. But before we dive into the details of the firm, I want to know more about you, Amos. So when did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Okay, so that's a good question, because did I ever discover my passion to architecture? That's maybe the main question.
That's a good question.
Did I choose this path from the right reasons? So did I come to the right decision? These are the questions that kind of followed me through school. So you have to realize that in Israel, after you finish high school, you go to military, which is compulsory. So I spent 3 years in the military. And then I think most Israelis go for a very, very long vacation, which takes sometimes a couple of years. So I spent a couple of years working and traveling with my then partner, now my wife, for many, many years, which we traveled all over the Far East for about 9 months after working in New York and saving some money. So by the time I had to kind of settle down, it was 1993, and I was about 24, 25 years old. So in America, these type of ages, you're already past some of your schooling, maybe most of it.
Right.
And you're entering a professional life. But in Israel, this is kind of where you just start thinking what you want to do. And you don't have too much time to consider it. I think that the gap year, right? You guys call it the gap year.
Right.
You take like 6 years of gap year just between high school and college. So my dad was an architect. He passed, but he was an architect back when I decided. My mom is an artist. My brother is an artist and my sister is a designer. So what do I have to do with my life? And the easiest answer was, okay, I'll go study architecture.
Right.
And, you know, maybe I'll even join my dad's firm. It makes a lot of sense, even though he definitely wasn't an entrepreneur architect. He was more, some people call it a real architect with the quote marks, like somebody who is totally into construction and doesn't know anything about the business, but he was very, very passionate about the profession. He always had the incentive. He used to say, you know, architecture is not a profession. It's a way of life. You know, for me, it was very hard to hear because it put me as his child, like his third child, as in second place after his so-called life, which is architecture. So for me, it was hard to hear, but I still thought this was the right path for me. And I went to school and I started studying in Israel. And somewhere around third, fourth year, I realized that this is definitely not for me for different reasons. Even my ability to focus, connecting to the process of architecture. But I think the hardest part was being under his supervision, kind of looking down on what I was doing. And he wasn't an easy person to get along with. He was very critical, a person with a lot of critique. It was very important for him to critique all my work at school, which I couldn't bear. It was too much for me. And I ended up going to work for him after the fourth year of school.
So you graduated with architecture?
I went to a school that it wasn't accredited, so I had to go to finish a couple of more years in the States.
Okay.
That's what brings me to the next chapter.
Got it.
But when I went to his firm and I sat there for a few weeks, and all I had was a few weeks before I was leaving for years to finish my studies in New York, I said to myself, I'm never coming back here. And I also told him that. I told him, I cannot work with you. And he was very offended. He took it very, very tough.
Yeah.
He said, you know, at the beginning, it was playing like tough. And then he said, you know, you really hurt my feelings. I feel like you don't stand me. You can't be with me. But I told him, listen, this is what it is. I can't see myself when you're around. It's not me. And then I left to City College. And I did my BArch with two more years. The only thing he told me is at least finish your studies. I know that you may not want to be an architect, but his advice of finish school. And that I took very seriously.
Yeah.
And I went to City College and I finished the last couple of years. I had a great time. I loved City College so much. It was the opposite of studying in Israel. The people were so welcoming and everything was so positive. In Israel, everybody was so critical and you really got like beaten up every crit. The teachers were like killing you. And in the States, everybody is sort of positive, at least to the outside. It's a different culture in that sense.
City College must have a great culture because I have never met an architect who's gone through City College program who isn't passionate and really loves the school.
The school was wonderful and people from all over the world. And I have a lot of friends from there. One of my best friends in the States, who is also an architect, is from there. I picked him up in City College. I had a great person I met in Italy who is still one of my best friends. And I came out of that school with a notion that I have to do something else.
So you knew right away, coming out of architecture school.
Coming out of architecture, I said, I'm going to finish these 2 years no matter what. I'm going to beat myself up, but I'm not going to give up after 4 years and leave without a degree because it really is a waste of time.
Yeah.
At least I'll get the degree. But after that, I promised myself that I'll do anything not to be an architect.
Resisted it all the way through.
You go out to the workplace with the worst attitude possible. So you find yourself, you know, in firms or at the beginning, I worked for my professor. The firm was RKT&B in Manhattan. One of the partners was my professor and he took me in. And I couldn't see myself doing shop drawings or different schedules, door schedules, and putting dimensions on plans. In my imagination, I was supposed to be designing these huge buildings and being on the real architect that you're supposed to be. And then the profession comes back and tells you, no, you're starting from scratch here. You just sit in that desk and sit on the computer. And people were sleeping in their desks sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, firms are hard sometimes. The atmosphere sometimes can be a little sleepy. And I was very, very energetic. I had to be somewhere where the action is. And I mean, people around me saw that. And one of the employees in the firm, it's a crazy story. One of the employees said to me once, we have a client. His name is Jonathan Leidersdorf. Look him up. He's one of crazy billionaire. I don't know if he's a billionaire already, but he's somewhere up there. And Jonathan is a client of ours. We did some work for him. And he's an architect also, and he employs architects. Let me introduce you to him. So a couple of days later, I go to this Jonathan's office, this amazing rooftop office on Fifth Avenue, somewhere downtown Fifth Avenue, with sculptures from India. Everything is glass. It's like antique and modern. The most beautiful place I've ever been exposed to some riches. Okay, so I come from humble origins. I come from a kibbutz. I don't know if you know what that is. It's like a commune in Israel. I grew up on a commune and all of a sudden I'm seeing these riches in front of me. And this young Jonathan guy is an Israeli. And of course we connect. I mean, we have the same energy. He's older than me, but not too old, maybe 5-6 years older than me. And he says, yeah, sure. Come on and work with me. I don't have a problem. Come and join me. And I find myself sitting in that loft kind of space with a couple of other architects, apparently working on this building that his family owns in Tel Aviv, designing it. I don't want to say, but these guys were just doing nothing. I mean, three architects working on a building and designing and redesigning it and redesigning it. Like there's no goal for this. And the guy has so much money, doesn't care how much time he spends on it. And he doesn't really care about what we're doing. So in a way, it was like another grave, you know? So now I'm going from boredom to super boredom. Like there's no action, except the crazy part that in front of me, I'm talking maybe 10 feet or 5-6 feet in front of me. He's sitting, Jonathan Leidersdorf is sitting next to a huge desk and he's talking about multi-million dollar deals in high tech. So this guy is like, later I learned he's one of the first investors in ICQ. I don't know if you remember them. They were from Israel. ICQ was the first messenger.
Oh, yeah.
In AOL. If you had AOL back in the 90s, and then you started communicating via messenger, this was the first time ever. No, and ICQ sold to AOL for $500 million. So he was after that exit already.
Yeah.
Coming from a wealthy family, he invested millions in that company when they just started. And now he's, you can see that he's into that and he has a huge appetite and he's investing in these huge startups and he's talking to millions of dollars. And I'm sitting there and just like jealous as hell, trying to say something. And I can't get myself to tell him, Jonathan, get me out of this, help.
The entrepreneur was dying to come out.
Help me do something that will get me excited. Start companies, do something. Well, I think maybe a month or two passed and there was a point where I don't know why he told me he needed to bring him to a bar. He was sitting at a couple of sheets of paper or something. I don't even remember, but I found myself in a New York afternoon, probably sunny New York afternoon, sitting with him at a bar all of a sudden. This guy had a butler. So I wasn't on his radar. This guy had butlers. He had like staff. He was filthy rich, but I found myself sitting with him at a bar. And he said, okay, would you like a martini? And I say, sure, why not? I'll drink a martini with you. And we drink a martini. And then, you know how they say when the alcohol comes in, the secrets go out, right? There's a saying.
And yes.
I just blurted, Jonathan, I don't want to be an architect. So this is something, you know, it's very hard to tell your boss that you don't want to do what you're doing for him. And he looked me in the eyes. I remember this to this day. And we're talking about 1999. That's a long time ago. He looks me in the eye and he said, don't worry, I'll take care of you. And that's it. That's all I heard. And the next day I come to the firm and it's the same. And the next day it's the same. And I think maybe a week or two passed by. And then all of a sudden the elevator opens up one day. And, you know, the elevators were just into the loft, straight into the loft.
Yeah.
Out comes a short guy with a suit that's two sizes larger than him, into with the large glasses. He looks like a nerd, but he doesn't really look like he's an Israeli, of course. And Jonathan grabs him by the arm and he brings him to my desk. He brings him to my desk and he tells him, he is working for you now. That's what he said.
You don't even know who he is.
I don't know who he is. And this was basically kind of a breaking point in my life because he introduced me to a person named Ronnie Zarum, who by that time was about a year into starting his startup, which Jonathan invested in. Okay. The startup was called Exalink, and they were trying to provide data access to cell phones. This is 1999. Just imagine how early this is, the concept.
Yeah.
He was trying to get cell phones to be able to connect to your bank account. Okay. There was a lot of security issues with that. And the infrastructure wasn't set up, but that was the startup. And that's what he was pitching. And I became the first US employee of Exalink.
Wow.
And I was sitting in the same place with the same computer, but I wasn't an architect anymore.
Oh, so you didn't move?
I didn't move my desk.
So you just changed your roles and your responsibility.
I changed my roles and I all of a sudden became, he called it operation manager in the US. And all of a sudden I was looking for offices in New Jersey to get the US headquarters up. And I was designing and I was interviewing people and the action really kicked in and everything was pretty exciting. And I was kind of doing it alone and on my own because the whole team was in Israel. And then 3 months later, Ronnie Zarum sold Exalink for $550 million. 3 months later, this guy who seriously came from nothing, even less than I came from, all of a sudden became a multi-millionaire. He had 46% of Exalink on the day of the sale, which is very high.
Yeah.
He didn't even have time to raise too much money. Jonathan, of course, made a lot of money from Exalink.
And who did they sell to?
They sell to Converse, which is another Israeli company. They were into the switchboards. They used to do switchboards, everything about telephone industry. This Converse, it's a long story. The technology didn't go anywhere. Ronnie became a wealthy entrepreneur. He started other companies and he also started an amazing non-for-profit in Israel to educate kids on business. I love this guy. I'm still in contact with him. But what happened is, he said, okay, I don't want you to go to work for the company that bought us. And he wanted me to start kind of an investment firm in New York with him. And all of a sudden, I was the first employee of Decima Ventures, which was Ronnie Zarum's way to spend his money now that he just made so many, 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 many ones.
Right.
So I found myself surrounded by all this money and it made me very hungry to be successful. And I want to tell you, young people who may be listening to this, being next to people who have money does not make you rich. They will not give you any of their money. Okay.
Yes.
They may give you assignments. They may give you knowledge. They may influence you in different ways, but they'll not part from their money and give it to you. Even if you create amazing value, they'll just give you the minimum necessary to keep you with them. And I realized that pretty fast that, so now I'm with Ronnie and we're starting companies and we're doing business plans and we're interviewing these huge companies coming in to pitch their ideas. So, you know, I could, bottom line, we called it the Ronnie's Arm School of Business because this, what I really got educated about starting a business from A to Z. even from mistakes and things that we did for nothing. Money we just wasted because money wasn't an issue all of a sudden with Ronnie. We built him amazing offices overlooking Bryant Park in the city. And we had a great time. We built a huge team. We flew all over the world. It was the crazy times.
And was your role in that company the same as the last tech company where you sort of have all the hats and doing all different types of work?
At one point, Ronnie brought a CEO and he brought a CFO because we're talking big money, but I was kind of, I don't know, we still called it operation manager.
Yeah.
I did everything.
So running all the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. Being involved in all the kind of analyst stuff. I was doing analyst stuff. I was doing various tasks within looking into businesses and interviewing entrepreneurs and ideas.
At that time, did you enjoy that? Did you think that that was your passion and you finally found your path?
No, I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
But I was always on how I make my own business.
Got it. So that idea of having your own business, that was from way back, right?
My own business started, I think, when I, you know, the first moment I left school.
So you knew you wanted to have your own business.
My own business, and this is the only thing that can make me eventually make me happy.
So through all these steps, you were looking at them as stepping stones to get to where you want to go.
Exactly. Even there was a point, I forgot to mention that in Jonathan, since, you know, everything was .com, I even had an idea for a .com for architecture.
Yeah.
I called it tsquare.com. And I took an idea from a, I don't know if you know, like big firms, they have these intranets. So you go into the firm and you open a browser and all of a sudden you have all the details you need and all the drawing sheets and everything.
It's like an internal internet.
Internal. So I was thinking about doing that and selling it to architecture firms, and Jonathan didn't want to invest in my idea. Not surprisingly, but I had a pitch and I was working on it, and I was very excited to. So I already pitched some ideas, but you know, this whole thing was a learning process and I knew it was a learning process. And eventually Ronnie kind of dissolved his New York presence, and I was looking at what's going to happen next. And I took a leap of faith and I started a business with zero money, zero experience. The idea I had came from a friend of mine, friends of mine, actually my wife's sister and her husband. At the time, they were working in Denver and they were selling this gadget. And I said to myself, I can invent gadgets that you can make in China for less than $1,
yeah,
that you sell in the store for $10. I can do that. I'm sure I can do that. Little did I know that you need startup money. Doesn't matter what you do, you need startup money. And I did invent a bunch of stuff. I even imported stuff from China that I invented, but everything crashed in a couple of years. I found myself in deep debt, desperate to get back and get a job. And what's the job that you can find if you're an architect? You can find a job as an architect.
Right, right, exactly.
So after this huge failure, which I enjoyed, but put my family at risk and it was very dangerous financially, I ended up with the huge amounts of garbage I made in China. Different crazy stuff, by the way. I invented crazy things, which were pretty amazing, but had no startup money backing it and couldn't pursue that in any way. One thing.
So if you had the backup money, if you had investment, do you think that that company would have grown?
In order for someone to succeed in that kind of company, product company, you need at least $1 million investment. And this is back in the 2000s, early 2000s. So that's a lot of money.
Right.
And I came in with zero, tried to do it. And
yeah.
Just a note for entrepreneurs. Side note, if you're an entrepreneur and you're listening, the minimum you need is the money that you take home every month just to pay the rent and buy food. And if you need childcare, if you need transportation. So that's the minimum amount before you need money to start the business. So if you even don't have that,
right,
the risk you're taking is huge. So if anything, you're jumping into entrepreneurship and you want to start a business, at least find a way to fund yourself for the 6 months or a year it's going to take. Sometimes if you need to save $60,000 to take home $5,000 a month, that's not too crazy. It takes a couple of years. You spend that money. And then for 1 year, you know that you don't have to pull a salary.
Right.
And in that 1 year, you could start generate some income. But if you jump into this crazy idea of creating gifts that you need to buy from China on credit, and you don't even have the money to take home, then you're up for failure.
So what happened after the business failed?
So after the business failed, I found work as an architect in different positions. I started with a neighbor of mine, invited me to work in his firm. I just worked as an architect. I did some extra jobs. I was working my ass off 20 hours a day, architecturing.
Still in New York.
Still in New York, all as freelance. So I had, you know, it's easier in terms of taxes, kept more of the money. And eventually I found myself about 6 months or a year before I went back to Israel, working for a huge fashion mogul called Eli Tahari. Look him up. He's number one in women's suits, by the way, still. Hot couture, really crazy guy, but wanted an architect to work inside the company. This is like a $500 million a year sales company with a lot of stores. So we did stores, we did offices, but he liked talking to me in Hebrew because kind of a cultural thing. And then my dad, so Eli Tahari, bought a property in Tel Aviv. And this property is a public building, and he wanted to appease the city to get some building rights. So he started redecorating the building and doing renovations. And he sent me to supervise these decorations. This is January 2006. I go to Israel. All of a sudden, I see that my dad can't talk. Okay, so he's losing his voice. So, you know, sometimes it sounded a little bit maybe like something on in his throat or whatever. And then a few months later, we go back on vacation. It's maybe March or April, and the situation is much worse. Okay, so now he can hardly talk. Because of this gap in the time I was there, I saw how fast it's deteriorating.
Yeah.
It ended up being ALS, what you guys sometimes call Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
One of the worst diseases in the world. At the time, we didn't know it, but I had a feeling that the pace which he's losing his voice is not going to allow him to keep the firm. So, I mean, you can't be an architect if you can't talk. And he's doing these public projects, a few projects at a time, him and a couple of employees and a secretary. And then we did want to go back to Israel eventually. By now, we've been in New York for 9 years. Had two of the older daughters born there. And my mom is in New York at the time. She's been living there for 40 years. Now she's living with me in Israel. But by then she was still in New York. We had a family, but we did want to go back to Israel, back to the old country.
Yeah.
The idea was not to be immigrants. We didn't want to immigrate. To be an immigrant, it was a price. The kids talk to you in English and you talk to them in Hebrew. It becomes an issue. And my brother lives in the States. So we decided to go back that summer to be able to save what's left from the firm.
So when you went back with the intent of going back to work and working with your father? Or
yes, because he lost his voice.
Yeah.
So that connects to me saying to him, I'll never come work with him.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, RCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at rcat.com under the resources tab, or just go to rcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's rcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
So now I go back, but this strong, individual, powerful architect, opinionated, by the way, Holocaust survivor, just so you know. Hmm. So this guy survived the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Came to Israel and was 9 years old. and, you know, made something of himself. Crazy story. That's a totally different podcast of what he went through. But this powerful person all of a sudden can't speak.
Yeah.
So it allowed me to come into the firm with two ideas. First of all, I knew he wouldn't be able to survive. The deterioration was obvious.
Yeah.
Something was going on pretty obvious, pretty tough for him. Therefore, it's not that I'm going to be his partner. There's going to be a change of guard here. And that was very obvious to me. And it gave me an opening. And I called up Tomer, which I knew from school. And back in 93, when we started together in Tel Aviv in this architecture school, everybody knew Tomer was going to be the best choice for partner. He is an amazing architect. Today, one of the leading architects in Israel in transportation, specifically in transportation, very, very intelligent. And also we share a lot of values. And this is maybe the main thing to start a business, is to find the right partner.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Especially somebody like you who didn't really want to do the architecture side. You only wanted to do the business side. So you need to find somebody who's passionate about the architecture side.
Exactly. And I had that person, which is crazy.
Yeah.
I had that person. And all I had to, he was at the time just kind of starting to be fed up with his job in the firm that he worked. And he told them, okay, guys, if you don't want to raise my salary more, I'm going to go down to 4 days. And this last day of the week, the fifth day of the week, he came to work with me. My dad was already kind of on the side. And we took the couple of projects that we had and he helped me produce them and work on them. And that was, we call that the dating period, because we really had the experience of working together and without the commitment. And by the time a couple of years passed, my dad deteriorated very fast. He lost his ability to walk and talk and move. And this is what the disease does to you. And we wheeled him into the office seriously until the last moment, just so he'll have some comfort. He came with this caretaker into the firm just to be there a little bit. But it was very important for me to be there for him as much as I could. But, you know, he wasn't part of what me and Tomer started building together at that point. And then in 2008, we moved the firm out of Tel Aviv, closer to where we live, so we don't have to commute in the morning. And we started the Peleg Kleinhaus. And he went to bring his transportation contacts and told them now he's on his own. And we started bringing projects from there.
Did you start that as a new firm, or was that a transition from your father's firm?
In every shape and form, it was a new firm. Since we had to fire everybody, and we only had about one project to carry on from the old firm, which was good. It's kind of a large hospital project that we can rely on for income for a little bit. But it was him and me and about 1,400 square foot of space. Since we rented it with the thought that we're going to fill it up.
I did the same thing.
Yeah.
And spent 4 years in an empty office.
And we looked at that space and we said, this is it. This is what we're going to do here together.
Yeah.
And I think that if I have like a perspective of where I was at that point, I remember the moment when we finished setting up the office. I think it was like late at night and we were dead tired. We moved all the furniture we could and we kind of laid on the cold floor, ceramic floor, exhausted. And I was happy as a person can be. So this is it. I'm here. I'm starting.
You have your business.
Yeah, exactly. It was just the start of all the craziness.
Yes.
Of what it means. So this is the origins. And from here on, I think I took all the lessons I've learned from the crazy stuff that I did and the crazy stuff that I saw other people doing and my experiences in New York and around the world in different businesses that I saw. And I just put it all into play, all the lessons that I've learned. But it's still a learning curve. For example, if you start a firm, this is just tip number one. The thing that you think is going to be most difficult is to bring in the work. Okay? That's wrong. The most difficult part is to find the right people.
Yes.
To do the work. So if I knew that, maybe I had a little bit different focus. It took us a long time to understand that, but we shifted the focus on hiring the right people and letting the wrong people go as soon as possible, not letting them linger. which really contributed to the expansion of the firm.
When you say the right people and the wrong people, what are you talking about in terms of right and wrong? Is it about skill and talent and knowledge, or is it more about culture and personality and good fit for the culture?
I think it's always both, but it's first culture and personality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the first thing when we do a year-end employee reviews at the end of the year, we do in December, beginning of January, and, you know, we hand out the bonuses, etc. The first thing I tell these people is, I'm glad to see you in the morning, okay? That's the most important thing for me to tell them.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to be here if I'm not happy to see you in the morning. If you come in and I get irritated just a little bit, that means that it's not going to work, because this thing is me fulfilling my dreams and aspirations, and you guys have to be on the same page, and then you can enjoy the profits as well.
So you've learned all these lessons through this story, or all the different steps that you've taken. You've launched this firm. You recognize that the culture and the people in the firm are the priority. What other than that, maybe that's the answer, but you launched it from nothing, basically. And today it's one of the most successful firms in Israel.
Not one of the most successful, but it's pretty successful. Let's put it this way.
So a successful firm in Israel, let's put it that way. What would you say is the most important thing that you got right, other than getting the people and the culture right, to be able to grow it from nothing to what you've built it into today?
So the first thing I would say, and this is also kind of an advice, is for your specific location and maybe even your specific skills, find the money river. Where is the money flowing? Okay. So I know people are afraid to talk about money, and money sometimes is not an easy thing to deal with, but it's all about the money. So don't think otherwise, that you can avoid thinking about the money.
So you're talking about the building type and client type?
Exactly. So just ask yourself, where is most of the fees going to? So at the beginning, we said, okay, maybe we need to specialize. So let's do a sustainable architecture. Okay. Let's be sustainable.
Yeah.
And then we market ourselves as sustainable. And then I looked at the fee structure of a simple project, and the architect was getting 3-4% of the construction cost, and the sustainability advisor got 0.1%. So yeah. Probably that's not where the money is, right?
The money's not flowing there.
It's not flowing there. Don't go there, because it's not going to make you successful. So that's in terms of the fee structure. You want to focus on something where the big funds go to. In terms of the type of projects, we decided we're only going to do national projects. Okay. National meaning it's either government agencies. Okay. Or organizations that have national, and this is in the States, it's on a state level. So Israel is only 10 million people. So we're talking about New Jersey size.
Right.
That's it. So if you're located in state and size of New Jersey, so state level projects. Local, we didn't even go after local community level projects, because at the local level, less money. So what does the state do that's on the national level?
Right.
And then we focused on hospitals and on clinics. All the healthcare in Israel is a very high level, especially in the community. So you get these big, big clinic chains of like a community clinic. It's not a hospital.
Yeah.
It's where you get the normal care, we call it.
Right. Yeah.
So these chains have 200 branches, 100 branches. And then we have a big bank, 160 branches. And then we have Israel Rail has 100 train stations. And then we have a light rail, 5 stations. So each of these clients have a lot of locations, and that's where all the fees go.
Yeah.
So if we're focusing on big, big companies, and I was looking at companies that have at least 12,000 employees, because 12,000 employees start needing dining rooms. They need bathrooms. They need work areas.
Yeah.
So don't go and go after a client that you'll know it's going to be a one-time project.
Right.
Every time I market myself, I tell to the potential client, listen, we're not after you because you have a project. We're after you because we want you as an account. And this I learned in America, in the States. So when I introduce a client into the firm, I tell them, you're a new account for us, like an advertising company.
Right, right.
This is my new account. And now everything you need from, you need me to choose the color for your new cabinets and storage room? Fine. You need me to design a 20,000 square foot warehouse? Perfect.
Right. So you're looking for recurring client projects and you're looking for clients that have large budgets. So national projects.
Exactly.
Hospital chains, banks, they all have lots of money to be able to do the projects that they want to do.
Lots of money. They have to. Sometimes they have to do them because they need to expand and they need to serve their clients. And that worked very well. And I still have a list from about 15 years ago where I have all the largest companies in Israel marked for Concor, and I maybe have half of them already. It's always expanding a niche. So if you have hospitals, you market yourself as you can do labs, okay? If you do labs, you can do education. If you do education, you can do sports. So always try to expand the niche. That's another thing, and very good advice I have. I think it's good advice. Every business advisor, every person coming from the business world will tell you that you have to specialize, right?
Right.
So if you're an architect, you have to specialize in residential or multiple living or industry or offices. But the secret is to do and, not or, okay? So if you specialize in transportation and hospitals and high tech and labs, and that means you can grow in each of these specialty areas, not only in one of them. And by the way, none of them know about the other specialty.
Right.
And they don't really care.
So you're still marketing yourself as a specialist, but you have multiple specialties.
Depends who I'm talking to. That's it.
Right.
If I'm talking to a high tech company, I'm going to tell them 100 times that I do kind of stuff for Intel, which is true.
Right.
And Intel, and I did this for Elbit and Intel, and we did Microsoft, and we did that, and we did Google, and they're all in Israel, and we did offices for some of them. And, you know, and then they don't know nothing about me doing clinics. And if I tell them that I do clinics, it's going to turn them off immediately.
Right.
You specialize in healthcare. No, we're not interested. But again, specialty doesn't need to be or, it can be and. So remember that it's a good tip because eventually something will really grow at one time and then it'll stop and then the other thing will grow.
Yeah. And that's a very different thing than being a generalist architect, right? You're not describing a generalist, right? That you can do anything for anybody. But a lot of architects think that they're generalists and they want to be generalists. They want to be able to design anything for anybody. But what you're saying is something very different. Right, that you should specialize in one thing and then specialize in another thing and then specialize in another thing. And all your marketing, when you're talking to those different groups, you're only marketing that you are a specialist in that market, that you're not saying, I can do everything for anybody. You're saying, I can do this one thing for this.
I have presentations for every type of client ready to be sent out. And what you said about generalist, it's hard to say it, but I don't think that exists anymore. Seriously.
I agree. But I think a lot of architects think there are.
Even just, you know, take the simplest type. There's another tip I want to talk about regarding competition, which comes from the notion of being a residential architect. Okay? People hire, in my country at least, residential architects are very specialized in residential architecture. This is maybe the most general type of architecture, right? Doing private homes. Everybody, I did my home, I did my aunt's home. So everybody did some homes, right? So that's maybe the generalist architect main go-to, but people are looking for architects to specialize in residential properties, especially because of the permitting, because the architect knows how to permit and he knows how to get through permitting fastest, etc. And that brings me to another tip, I think, is for people who want to start their own firm. Besides having the best partner in the world and focusing on the money stream, don't go to places where there's too much competition, okay? Try to individualize yourself as much as possible. You know, this is crazy. We do technical rooms for mass transportation, okay? You can say that it's not architecture, but there's a ton of architecture in a room that's about 5,000 square feet buried underground, full of equipment that needs to be, a technician needs to be able to go in and maintain. And it's under so many rules and regulations. And it's this huge infrastructure project that's costing about $4 or $5 billion. Billion, not million. $5 billion is spent on building a light rail. And you're doing the technical rooms. But all of a sudden, you specialize in technical rooms and you get a call from another company. We need to do technical rooms in a tunnel for a train. And for me, this is the best place to be. There's maybe 5 architects that know how to do this.
Right.
You don't want to be in a place where there's 500 architects who know how to do this.
Right.
You want to choose the niches that are least attractive. And oh, again, I'm saying it because I'm looking at the business side.
Yeah.
But even my partner, who is a great architect, he knows the value of designing infrastructure projects, which are not sexy. And you can't mostly, normally you will not publish them in a magazine. Okay. You don't want to even take pictures when they're done. But this is our profession. We put together buildings and it doesn't matter what function they have.
Right.
We not only that we put together these buildings, we lead the team and we become leaders of this big, huge processes where so much money is involved. You sit in meetings with 30, 40 people and you're the only one who knows what you're talking about. It gives you so much satisfaction and also pride because we're building the country in many ways. And again, these are niches that not too many architects will even bother going into. So find these niches that nobody wants to do. And even start from something that you're not crazy about and build from that.
Yeah.
Build your niche, build who you are in this industry. And generalist, it sounds so off-putting.
Well, so many lessons shared today, Amos. I think that architects who are listening are taking a lot of value from your story and the different lessons you're sharing today. As we wrap up our conversation today, I want to ask you the final question that I ask all my guests. And I'm interested to hear what your answer is. What would be one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow? What's the one thing you would leave them with?
Well, I think the one thing is to, you know, there's something called the ikigai. I don't know if people know that in the Japanese culture. Just look it up. I-K-E-G-E-I-A-I or ikigai. Okay, so this chart is basically, it's built out of 4 circles, okay?
Okay.
So one circle is what I'm good at, okay? The other circle is what I'm passionate about. The third circle is what the world needs. And the fourth circle is what the world is going to pay me for.
Yes.
Okay? And the conjunction of these 4 circles, you just Google it, is where you should be.
Yeah. Ikigai. Is that what you said? Ikigai.
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 It's a table. It's all over Google. And then,
yeah.
So if you find the conjunction of what you're passionate about, but also what you do best and get paid for and is good for the world.
Right.
That's where you'll find, you know, where you want to be in life.
Yeah. You'll find happiness.
I can say for myself, I'm very happy. I'm not only happy, I feel that I'm fulfilled and I always say that, you know, I already arrived. I have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
I go into the office every day with a smile, with still a dream to bring in more projects and make more clients happy. But I'm not aspiring to anything because I already have everything.
Yeah.
In a way. So it puts me in the place kind of, you know, a little bit in a higher place in many ways.
For sure. Yeah. Very inspiring. Very inspiring story. Many inspiring lessons. His name is Amos Peleg. Peleg Kleinhaus Architects is the firm's name. If you want to go take a look at some of the work that they've done, it's KPARC. So it's kparc.co.il. So kpark.co.il. It's all Hebrew. So if you don't speak Hebrew,
just hit the translate button.
Yeah. So you can translate it through Google. But some great photographs of the work that they do.
And my email is there. You can contact me and I'm happy to help in anything.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing your story today. Very inspiring. Lots of great lessons. I appreciate you. And I appreciate you coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it very, very much.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, two a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days will give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember three words: love, learn, share. Have a great day. Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.